putting the recording on. I hope you can hear me out there. Is it on? So last night I did promise that today, this morning, I will talk about anicca, impermanence, suffering and non-self. That was my promise. But all things are impermanent, so I might talk about something else. But no, I keep my promises. And it does lead on from what I've been talking before, because these are the insights which one can get a result of meditation, and they work on daily life as they work in your meditation as well. And so one of the first great teachings which should really help each one of you is anicca, you know, things don't last, this too will pass. And I don't know how many times that, you know, part of my job is to be a counsellor, and I often tell people the reason why monks are very good at counselling, why they're very popular, is because we're free. We're cheap. So we're good value for money. But also that, you know, you do understand a lot about the nature of the mind, and so that what you say can be very profound. In fact, you know, these days that many of the counsellors and psychologists in Australia and throughout the world get all their wisdom from the monks, from Buddhism. Anyhow, the story I often love telling, Emperor's Ring, very quick story, it's in Opening the Door of Your Heart. Young man became the emperor, didn't really know what to do, had not that much training, and so whenever things were going well in his kingdom, he'd have a party, celebrate. And because he was spending all the time partying and celebrating, he wasn't doing enough work to keep the country strong, the economy booming. I've seen that in places like Australia. Yeah, we're out of the GFC. We got lots of money coming in for mining, let's spend it all. And now they're in trouble in Australia, because they spent too much, and they got no money coming in, iron ore prices have gone down. That's typical of the emperor's ring, emperor, who when times are good, celebrate, spend, let the good times roll as if they will never end. That's the story of stock market crashes as well. You know, when times are going well, we spend, invest, we're stupid. We think the good times will never end. So he partied and spent, and so soon his country was in depression, regression, recession, all of them. And so he got so upset, he didn't sort of hang himself or jump out the window of his palace or what sometimes people do. Instead, he just stayed in his room, just moping, depressed, dull. And of course, you can't tell an emperor what to do. That's like giving advice to Kim Jong-un. You know, you end up bang. So instead, the ministers, well, how can we tell our emperor, you know, that's not the way to run a kingdom? And so they came up with this great idea. They got a goldsmith to make him a very simple ring, because these wealthy guys, they like a little bit of jewelry as well. So they presented this ring to the emperor, and he would wear it on all occasions, a simple ring except for the words engraved on the outside, "This too will pass." This too will pass, engraved on the outside. And that was all the emperor needed. When the bad times were happening, it will pass. You know, when you know there's light on the end of the tunnel, you know it's going to pass. It's quite easy to endure. You know it's soon going to disappear. You do that at work. Go to work on Friday, this too will pass, it will soon be Saturday, the weekend. You can do that having operations. You know, even giving birth, you know, it's painful, but you know, in this few hours and it's over, and you've got this beautiful baby to cuddle and look after. If you know it's going to end, you can endure. And not only you endure, because you know it's going to end, work. You know, so it motivates you. So because in the bad times he knew it would end, he never really got so depressed. He could be active, he worked hard, even in difficult times. And then, when times were going well, and this is the most important part of the story, when there was prosperity, lots of wealth in the kingdom, lots of happiness, he never ever took it for granted. He worked even harder in the good times. Because he knew happiness, health, relationships, they're fragile. They can so easily be broken down and destroyed. So because of that, he never took all the good things for granted. He worked even harder to preserve health, prosperity, happiness, love. So much so that the good times lasted longer than anyone could ever remember. And the bad times were quite short. He became a wonderful emperor. And, of course, you apply that to your life. You're always going to have difficulties and suffering. And you know what I said yesterday? Anyone who says, why me? Why does this always happen to me? And the answer is, why not? It could happen to somebody. So we all have our share of difficulties and problems. But when it does get difficult, please know it does pass. It's anicca. Even when you're very sick. I can't, I know you know this story many times, but I can't avoid telling it. When I was very sick in hospital, typhus fever, I mentioned about that nurse who stabbed me twice a day. Really felt bad. You feel bad enough with a fever, like typhus fever, same as typhoid. Actually the same as Ebola, they think, because, you know, it's just the same symptoms. You know, you don't, you know, you came close to dying, but really, 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 really bad. And then Ajahn Chah came to visit me. And just, now I was only a tiny monk, and this was this huge superstar monk. And I thought, wow, he's come to visit me. And yeah, you really get uplifted with happiness and sort of really feel good. And he came to my bedside, and, you know, you managed to get your hands up, just pay respects to your teacher. And then you looked in his eyes and expected something profound, or at least some kindness. Brahma Wangso, he said, you will either get better or you'll die. And off he went. However high I was, seeing my master went way down. It felt worse than when he came, before he came in. But I remember that. You can't question that. You can't argue with that. That's so true. So sickness doesn't last. And if ever you're in hospital feeling terrible, don't worry about it. You'll either get better or you'll die. If you go and see your mother or your father and she's in hospital, tell Mum. But maybe don't do that to your father. But at least you can do that to yourself. Remember that. It passes. And I remember somebody sent me an email with pictures after the Columbine massacre, I think it was. Was it Columbine? No, it was Virginia State or something. You know, a gunman went into that university campus. He shot about 40 or 50 students or something. And afterwards, someone sent me an email when they were doing memorial service. They were all wearing these hats with the words, this too will pass, around it. That's brilliant. Now that's big disaster, big problems, tsunamis, nuclear disasters, whatever. It passes. And that is all we really need, just to endure long enough, you know, for it to actually pass. We don't do stupid things like suicides or go into drugs or, you know, really get sort of down. We know it passes. So any difficulty you face, even in meditation, you know, if you really feel dull, you're really in a bad state, remember this too will pass, and I guarantee it always does. 100% money back guarantee. You either get better or you die. Don't they stick forever? No one does. So that is something in worldly life, you know, which can really help. So simple, apply to so many things, and so helpful. But we also apply it to the deeper stuff of life. And this is where I get into the deep insights. This is enlightenment stuff. Because most people, when they talk about impermanence, sometimes people call it rise and fall. And it's like going to the lake, or the river, or the sea, and seeing the waves, the whole heap of water, rise and fall, never the same. But that is only superficial. That doesn't make you enlightened. Anyone can see that. But what happens when you meditate? It is very similar to sitting down by the lake, seeing the lake, the waves go up and down, and then, without warning, not expecting it, the whole lake vanishes. It disappears. And all the earth and the sky above disappears with it. That is weird. Things which have always been there now are no longer there. And you never expected that. That is strange. Now that is a great simile of what happens to you in meditation. Already many of you have been meditating there and parts of your body vanish. They're not supposed to vanish. Okay, I can feel my hands, they can move, they can throb, they can be warm, they can be cold. Yeah, but I can feel them and then suddenly they're gone. Ah, who's taken them? A Singapore person, remember, they hadn't meditated much before, and they came up to me and they were just, you know, almost ready to leave, you know, the retreat. So what happened? What happened? I was meditating, my hands disappeared. Well done. Well, that's good. Yes, very good. Let's get rid of the rest of your body as well. I don't know about your body, but my body really sucks. It's getting old now. It's my 64th year. It's falling apart. Imagine you had a car for 64 years in Singapore. If you had a 64-year-old car, how many people have got 64-year-old cars? You want to trade it in and get a new one? Sorry? Vintage, yeah, might okay for a showroom or for a museum, but not on the roads. So when you get old, things start to fall apart. That's always the case. What is that old story of old age? The two men sitting in the park together, not the one about, you know, I told the first day. Two sitting in the park together, and one is just, like most old people do, they talk about operations, the pain, the next operation, when they're going to have next week. And that's what old people talk about, because they're falling apart. And he was talking about how everything aches and, you know, couldn't eat what he wanted and couldn't do what he liked and couldn't walk and just his eyes were no good and all sorts of stuff like that. And he was just, you know, really depressed. And his friend said, you know, he asked, how do you feel? And his friend, I'm 85 now and I feel like a newborn baby. How can you feel like a newborn baby at 85, said his friend, aching and moaning. Well, look at me. Just like a newborn baby. I've got no teeth, no hair. And actually, I've just wet my pants. Just like a newborn baby. So that's what we start off with, and that's what we end up. It's true, you know, you start off with nappies. You end up with nappies, too. Many of you don't think you have got past nappy time. You live long enough, and you'll get another nappy about you. So, we have all this body, and have you noticed when you start meditating, no matter how many cushions you have, it's never quite right. There's always an ache here, an itch there, there's a noise, there's something disturbing it. Saliva, you know, tummy, you burp, you let forth wind. You can't stop it. And the older you are, the more this body doesn't sort of obey instructions. So when I meditate, just this body is just, you know, it's okay, you get used to it, but it's not comfortable. But then when my body vanishes, now that's comfortable. You don't worry about heat or cold, you can't feel the body anymore. That's why I always say it's much better to meditate when it's very cold. Because you meditate when it's very cold, soon your body goes numb, it freezes, and you can't feel it anymore, then you're okay. But yeah, you know, are you warm enough? Are you cool enough? Ever. Sometimes it's never quite right. That's why in this hall, we really tried hard. I really tried hard to make this as comfortable as possible. And I did even think once. You know, my thought came into mind, how can I make it more comfortable? And have, you know, air conditioners where you just pull down, just above you. So you can actually have your temperature, you know, personalized air conditioned in your part of the hall. If you didn't like air conditioning, you don't have to have it. You have natural air. But, you know, just right, you know, Singapore temperature, Malaysia temperature, Indonesian temperature, you know, Thai temperature, Aussie, whatever. You can just get it just your temperature. You can even get the humidity just like at home. But you still won't be satisfied. So cushions. Designer cushions. Because your cushions, I mean, these have been around for years. Can't we do better than that? And I thought, why not? You know, we're a high-tech age. And this is 20, 30 years ago. You know, there's no buttons you can press to do things. So imagine you had a cushion. And you could press, you know, have a little remote control. Press it to inflate the back so your back goes up. You know, if your knees are sore, you know, press it this way. And that goes up. And if it's cold, you can increase the temperature. Or cool it down. And with another button you can press, you know, and you get a cup of coffee if you've got stuff and soften. Just wait where you are. Another one, so if you need to go to the toilet, you don't need to get up. You can just... I'm sure it can be arranged. You can empty it out at the end of the meditation day. But the reason we don't do that, I mean, it can be done. The reason you don't do that is you still won't be happy. The only way that my body is comfortable is when, bye-bye body, hands vanish, beautiful. Legs, I can't feel them anymore. Tummy gone. The first time I learned this was because I had to. That was in Thailand. In the first couple of years, when I thought these Thai monks were ascetic, but I didn't realize there was something else, another reason for this. We would meditate in the jungles from 6 to 8. That is dinner time for the mosquitoes. That's when they come out. And so you were meditating there. You know, no mosquito repellent, no mosquito calls, out under the trees. You know, it's just so romantic, isn't it? Like the Buddha, meditating under the trees in the jungle. No buildings, just like in the ancient days. You try it. You get swarmed by mosquitoes, hundreds of them, literally. And that was just so hard to bear. You know, I wonder why the Thai monks did this, but the Thai monks didn't get bitten. And it was a different metabolism. You know, I often say, you know, the joke that, you know, it's the first time Thai mosquitoes had Western food. That's why they were interested. But that's not the case. I found out later on, the metabolism of the Westerners is much more different. We're used to cold, so it's higher metabolism. And so actually, the, you know, we stood out more than the Thais did. So we always got bitten, you know, 50, 60 times to every Thai monk who got bitten. So for them, it was no problem sitting out there. But for the Westerners, it was torture. And I must say, I just really respect some of the other monks I was with who didn't have my level of meditation. They endured that. It was incredible. I could not endure that. So what I did, you know, one mosquito one, you know what it feels like. Imagine 70 or 80. I think we used to count up to 70 or 80 at one time. Ooh, but so waste time, you can't kill them. That was a problem. You're a monk. And your teacher, Ajahn Chah, is sitting just right in front of you. And you maybe, you know, if it wasn't there, you might break a precept or two out of desperation. But not when he's right in front of you. So all of your escape routes were all blocked off. So meditation. You know, go inside. And because of the mosquitoes, if I wondered, if I thought of anything, I'd be back on my body. So watching the breath, going really deep inside, letting go. And every one of those meditations, you got after 15 minutes or so, you know, you got to a place you couldn't feel your body anymore. You can imagine how much a relief that was. You know, you didn't know what the mosquitoes, they can be doing what they like. It's like being under anesthetic, but you know, your mind was really clear, just you couldn't feel your body. And that was so helpful. That's why, you know, it's unpleasant, but I thank those mosquitoes for teaching me how to let go of my body. The body vanished. It was anicca, not there anymore. And that's when I realized how peaceful and wonderful it is not having a body, because the body is suffering. But you'll only realize that when your body vanishes. You will realize that eventually when you die. And you'll be very fortunate if before you die you have a few practice runs called near-death experiences. Because people who have those near-death experiences, you've seen them on the TV. Who was that Singapore girl, you know, you went on the TV, Mo something or other, you know, floating out of her body, she came back, wrote a best-selling book, who's someone, I think, from the BF sent me all these videos of her. But anyway, near-death experiences. Remember, if you have a near-death experience beforehand, you're usually physically in a lot of suffering, a lot of pain. Hit by a car, operated on or something, it's unpleasant. But as soon as you leave your body, it's so wonderful. People have said, I remember one politician here wrote an article about it. He said, just the most peaceful and beautiful experience ever. He was hit by a landmine in the Vietnam War, floating above the paddy fields of Vietnam without a care in the world. People just so free and peaceful when you left your body. And the classic story was in a BBC documentary which somebody showed me. And it's classic because it was so funny, it made me laugh out loud. And when I tell the story, many other people sort of laugh as well, because it was an English girl, middle-aged. She was, a middle-age is about 60. For when you're 60, you know, we're always in middle-age. Old people are someone at least 10 years older than you, that's old. If you're 70, 70 is not old, that's middle-age. No, 80, that's old. But anyway, whatever age she was, you know, she died on the operating table and he was floating out, having the time of her life. Well, I should not say the time of her death, but I don't know. The time of something. Having a wonderful time, floating up, having a great time, feeling so free of this whole body which was creaking and things falling off, always needing maintenance. And she was met by another spirit. And the spirit said, "It's not your time. You have to go back," or something like that. And she said, "No, but you have to go back." "But I don't want to." "But you must go back." "No way. I'm having a much nicer time now than in this old body of mine. I'm not going back." And they had an argument on the psychic plane of existence. This spirit and this lady who'd just been dead. And in the end, the spirit won. And she said, what he did, he managed to somehow get hold of me and throw me back into my body. Literally, you know, by force. It was spiritual assault. And when she came to, she was in this painful old body. She'd just been in bliss land for a while. And a painful old body. And when she was interviewed, the funny part was just, what she said, when she got to that point, she screwed up her face. Now, it was like, "You're really angry, really upset at somebody." Screwed up her face. "I can't do this. I've not had enough practice." She said, "When I die next time, when I really die, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find that guy. I'm going to find him. And I'm going to let him have it. What he did to me is unforgivable." And she was really upset even thinking about this guy. If you think you've been cheated in business, you know, assaulted or whatever, now this is big stuff. She was really angry. But what that really showed, it emphasized that when your body vanishes, you have a wonderful time. Weird, but this is where you understand the nature of this body we're in. Because you're born in this body, lived all your life in this body, you know, you get used to it. It's just a simile of the prison. You're in this body, and it may be a very painful body, not so painful body, but look, all bodies are painful. Because we're used to it, we don't notice it anymore. But then one day you get free. You get out of jail. And you realize what this body is. There's always an ache. There's always an irritation. That's why it's so hard to sit still. It's always something. You've got to rub your nose, adjust your glasses. You've got to, you know, scratch your legs over there. You've got to drink. You know, you've got to move your glasses again. You've got to adjust your cushions underneath you. You've got to stroke your hair. You've got to stroke your hair in the back over there. You've got to adjust your cloth. You know, you've got to adjust your scarf over there. Now, you don't realize you're doing that. Sometimes when you're meditating, not during a talk, you know, scratching your hair over there, you're scratching your front over there, changing glasses, you're scratching your hair over there. This is so usual, we don't notice it. You know, scratching your nose. You can't stop yourself doing it. It's normal. You did as well, should you know. It's so normal. We don't notice it. We take it for granted. We don't realize how demanding this body is. It doesn't leave us alone. Even when you're sleeping, it doesn't leave you alone. Always asking you to toss, to turn, to do this, to do that. That's why we're so used to this body. We don't realize how demanding, how much of a tyrant it is. It's like a prison which always tells us we've got to adjust our hair. Or something. So, when you're free of that, you walk out of that prison. And the prison vanished. That's anicca. What was there for such a long time has now vanished. Only now can you understand it was suffering. Before, you couldn't see it. And here we go to my favorite story. Even I have to do my nose as well. My favorite story of the tadpole and the frog. If you haven't heard this story before, I made this up. It's a great story, and it describes what we're talking about by anicca. The tadpole, born in the lake, grew up in the lake, lived all its life in the lake, will never be able to understand what water is. No more than a fish can understand what water is. It's always been there. How can a fish know what water is? But the difference between a tadpole and a fish is a tadpole one day grows into a frog. And as a frog, one day jumps out of the lake. And you can imagine what it must be like for a tadpole, now a frog, to leave the lake for the first time. That's scary. That's weird. They have never experienced anything like that before. Now they're on this great thing called dry land. And something which has always been there has vanished. Water. Water is anicca. It's disappeared. It's vanished. Something you always thought was there, which you couldn't see because it was constant, now has disappeared. And that is a great simile for meditation. When things vanish, only then do you know what they are. When your body vanishes, it's not there anymore, then you have a good understanding of what this body is. I remember quite a few times going to see autopsies and talking with the pathologist, and sometimes the coroner will be there. But the pathologist, we'd ask him, he said, you know, you cut up bodies all day. You know, how do you view the body? And he said, no, he compartmentalizes. This is not... You know, real life, he still has sex with his wife, he still loves his body and cares for it. You know, he just can't see it. His body is suffering. But if you actually leave your body, either near-death experience or much, much better, you get into a deep meditation, your body vanishes. The happiness you feel, the bliss which some of you have experienced, is because there's no more body to disturb you. It's the same happiness a prisoner feels when they walk out of jail. Freedom. Now, that's deep insight. You're having data which most people don't have. Which is why we talk about these jhanas and try to encourage you to have these jhanas. And they're not that difficult. You get them eventually. Your whole body vanishes and you're blissed out. Why? Where does that bliss come from? All happiness is because some suffering has vanished. I remember when I did walk out of that hospital after I never died. I don't know if I was right. It was either dying or get better. I chose the latter. I got better. When I walked out of that hospital, I never felt so healthy as after you've recovered from a sickness. The reason is because, you know, once you are healthy, after a few days, you take it for granted. You can't notice it anymore. But once the suffering has just ended, then you really notice it. That is why the happiness is just the end of suffering. When happiness ends, then that's more suffering. And once you understand just how much suffering this body is, you tend not to get attached to it anymore. You're not really concerned about having another body. A lot of people want to get reincarnated and get, you know, reborn again. But next time, I'll be a man. You guys are girls. I'll be a man next time, then I can do all this stuff. Stupid. And the guys say, no, next time I'll be a woman. And then I can dress up and I don't have to work so hard. No, that's not what a woman is, right? So one of my disciples, he really came up with this idea. And he said, I don't want to be reborn as a man or a woman. I want to be reborn as a dog. I didn't understand. Why do you want to be reborn as a dog? Well, look, use your intelligence, Ajahn Brahm. Dogs in Australia don't have to go to work. They get pampered. They get fed really nice food. Now, you don't have to be a vegetarian. You can eat whatever you like as a dog. And you can get scraps from the table, extra. And people really look after their dogs. If it's cold, they get nice dog clothes. They can even get their hair done if they want to get their hair done. They get good medical attention. And they have to do nothing all day except sleep. And maybe, you know, just be petted. That's your job, just to be stroked. And what a wonderful life it is as a dog. Absolutely no stress at all. Wouldn't you like to be reborn as a dog? Why not? But he had a good argument there, and I thought, hey, you've got a point there. You know, you don't have to work, you don't have to talk to people. You just have to just, you know, lick people. But then I told him, in places like Australia, I think Singapore as well, now if you get reborn as a dog, after a few weeks, you have to go to the vet, you know, to get de-sexed. And when I told him that, he thought, no, I don't want to be a dog anymore. That was the one thing which stopped his aspiration to be reborn as a lazy dog. But when you realize what a body is like, you know, you don't really want one anymore. You want to escape. Not trying to make this body better. Because it doesn't matter how healthy or how sick you are. But it's still a pain. And when it disappears, you have gorgeous fun. It means you see what the body is and you can detach from it. It's a simile of the tadpole. Only when it's out of the water as a frog could it know what water was. You only know what your body was when you've left it. That's anicca. And also understanding dukkha. And also understanding anatta. If this vanishes, it can't belong to me. There you are existing quite well without your body. As I say, your body is not a woman's body. So your body's a woman, sorry, but you're not a woman. No, you're not a man. You're not Singaporean. You're not sort of Ang Mo. You know, you're not German. That's just your body. Your mind has got no gender at all. It's got no nationality. You know, your mind has got no age as well. Amazing thing to know that many people, when you get old, yeah, your body can't do things, but your mind feels just the same as it always did, even in its 20s. Still have the same stupidities. You can't do anything anymore. So the mind is just, once you understand what this mind is, totally different from the body. And you've got direct experience of that, because the body's vanished. Number one, what that gives you, the great insight. Once the body vanishes, the five senses have gone and you're still there. Perfectly aware and actually much happier. I call that rehearsal for dying. Because when you die, what happens? Your five senses turn off. your body shuts down. That's called death. And for many people, and it's the craziest delusion in modern world, is that they think that once you die, that's it, you vanish, you disappear. And scientists say, there's no evidence that things happen afterwards. My goodness, there's heaps of evidence. That's why I sometimes get passionate about the dogmatism of science. It is not accurate, especially when it gets to consciousness. The evidence is compelling. The brain is dead. Consciousness continues. People have all these weird experiences when they die, floating out of their body, and seeing real things. The classic case, which no one can explain, except if you did actually leave your body, was this fellow in some old, I think it was in the UK, one of these old operating theatres in an old hospital. And these operating theatres, just like this building here, had these high windows. Just so no one can watch, when you were cutting up somebody. So it had high windows for light, but down in the operating theatre, was down, well, not as big as this, obviously. And this guy said he floated up, during the operation. He floating up towards the ceiling. And he saw a tennis shoe on the ledge on the inside of the operating theatre. Now these ones over here, maybe it's a small thing just on the ledge up there. You couldn't see it from down here. But this was a big ledge. He said there was a tennis shoe up there. So when he came to again, he said, you've got a tennis shoe in the operating theatre. No way. This is a sterile room. We don't have rubbish like that. And who would put a tennis shoe on the top there? You're crazy. But he insisted that he'd left his body and that he'd risen up and he'd see on the tennis shoe over there. So, of course, somebody got a ladder to have a look. And, of course, there was one up there. And they don't know how it got up there. They don't know why it was there. And they couldn't figure out how he could see it when he was on his back, with mask on, being operated on under full anaesthetic. But, that was strong evidence, truth, which cannot be explained any other way. So there's many evidence for your mind being totally different from your body. And this is what happens in meditation. The body's gone. Can't feel it. No senses. You can't hear. You can't smell. You can't taste. You can't feel. The other one, you can't hear anything. It's gone. But you're perfectly awake. And also happy. Straight away that takes away the fear of death. You're understanding what death is like. And it's not that bad. If only you could remember how you died last time, you wouldn't be afraid of death at all. Dying, yes, because that can be painful. But death itself is very pleasant. Free at last. And it continues. So that would actually change many people's philosophies of life. And would actually make them better people. I think I told a few of you that there's a couple of our members can remember their past lives. They did it through regression and other stuff. One through meditation, one through regression. Remember the guy who came, he had regression and he had accurate, really good memory of his past life. And with the names, all checked out, went to the places, saw where he used to live before. He still hasn't seen his grave yet, but he knows where it is. That's really cool. Imagine you go to a place, there's a gravestone there. So that's me underneath. That was me, that's my name. That's the date, yes, correct. I'm under there. Wouldn't that be cool? But anyway, he remembers everything. But the wonderful thing about that was that when he told us all, afterwards he said, in the previous days, he was an Australian, just a businessman. He said, in the old days, he said, maybe I'd take a drink with my friends. Can't do that now. Because with his memory of a past life came the understanding of karma. He really understood what the karma is and how powerful it is. And he says, even though it's tough, I have to keep the 5 precepts. I just can't not keep the 5 precepts when I've seen what I've seen. And so there was like an Australian, Angmo, keeping 5 precepts so perfectly, not because of faith, because of wisdom. He knows what past lives are. And he says, I have to. It's really rough, sometimes, can't have a glass of beer, which I used to like before I remember my blooming past lives. So if you still like to break your precepts, don't remember your past lives. Once you remember your past lives, that's it, you've got to keep precepts. And also being compassionate and kind and doing service. He has to do that. Because he understands what this whole life is about. And its purpose. Once you've seen a past life or two. So anyway, this is what happens when your body disappears. Access the mind. You know that past lives work. You know there is reincarnation. Because you know this mind is different than the body. Just that insight by itself is very powerful. Now you know that this thing called the mind, because that's the only thing left of the mind, that's different than the body, carries on, you've done it in meditation, you've found out what it's like. As I also say, nimittas, which you see in meditation, when your five senses begin to disappear, the same light you see when you die. You float up towards the light. Then you bliss out in the light. You do that while you're alive, so you can practice dying here in Jhana Grove. Get some experience before you do the real thing. And that's what happens. You get deep insight to what those things are. But if you really want to get fully enlightened, then what happens next? More things disappear. And the more they disappear, the more happiness you feel. You know, your body disappears and this light vanishes. All you've got left is just beautiful bliss. It is a path of disappearing. The art of disappearing. Of things vanishing. That's why I said in the beginning of this retreat, this is not a place where you attain things, but a place where you lose things. Where things vanish. And it is scary because, you know, you're going to different places you've never been before. Things which are always there, like the water for the tadpole, vanish. You're watching the lake and it disappears. That can scare you. But that's what's supposed to happen. And it's beautiful afterwards. As these things disappear and vanish, you understand these things are impermanent. They're not essential. They're not who I am. They just disappear. Water's not essential. The frog can live even better on dry ground. You can live even happier without a body. That's very nice. Very blissful. But the deeper things, which philosophy can never quite argue, can never quite find out, is when you go into deeper meditation, into the jhanas, so still. You know, I always say that if you want to be still, don't put forth effort, don't do things. Because stillness is the opposite of will. Whenever you will something, you destroy stillness. Whenever you let things be, stillness grows. And you get more and more still. Less and less doing. Less and less interfering. Until you become so still. When nothing moves, your will vanishes. Your ability to choose, to direct, to do things, is no longer there. That is one of the weirdest experiences. You can say that the first jhana that occurs because the will is just so tiny, it's almost vanished. But in the second jhana, it is really there. No will left at all. Perfectly still. Solid like a diamond, like a mountain. Immovable stillness. No sound. No body, just bliss which doesn't vibrate. And you can't do anything. When you come out of a state like that, wow, that really was strange and weird. The frog has been standing in another place where something which was always there has vanished. The will. Now, you can choose not to exert your will, or you can exert your will. You can come, you can go, but imagine if that had totally vanished. Your ability to direct your life, to control, to do anything. And that's gone. Now, you understand what this will really is. Once it's vanished, it's nothing to do with you. It's non-self. And surprise, surprise, it is dukkha. To will is to suffer. To do anything is to experience pain. But you don't know that. Because you always take your will to be your best friend. Me and my will. Sometimes my will is a bit stupid. Sometimes it chooses the wrong things. Or it does it that says the wrong things. But I'm not going to try and abandon my will. I'm just going to teach it how to be smart. That's why you come to listen to talks. So that you can make better choices in the future and have more happiness, less problems, by having wisdom, having compassion, and still having your will. That only goes so far. Yeah, you get happier, you get less problems, but that's not good enough. In the prison, the will is like the prison guard, who never allows you to sit still. You sit still, and it tells you to do things. Come on, move. You're not comfortable enough. Come on, think. You've got jobs to do afterwards. Come on, you've got to think about what you're going to do afterwards. Come on, you've got to do something. Turn off your mobile phone. Do something. Your will never allows you to be still. Even when you're meditating, it's that will which creates all those thoughts inside of you. It's that will which even gets the start of a nimitta, then you start doing something with it. The will interferes all of the time. And it's so hard to let that one go. You can't will the will to stop. That's more will. That's why the only way this works is to make peace. Let things be. Don't do anything. Not only is this method of meditation powerful, it's also pure because as you get into this state, you get into the state, understanding, if you wish, where you're going to go, a state of no will, a state of pure peace, of stillness. Nothing is going on there. And that is very weird and strange. Just like the dry land to the fog, the first time it stands up on it. But that's also where you get huge insights. This thing you call will, you realize is the problem, is the craving. My simile, trying to make up similes, the driverless bus. Life is a journey. The destination is not important, and the journey is even worse. And life is a journey. And your life's journey, how's it been so far? Too many things have gone wrong. Your bus has gone into terrible places. And you went, what's wrong with me? Why is it, get a relationship and it all busts up? Why is it, you know, make a choice, you know, to have this job and it doesn't work? Why is it I made a choice and I get cheated? Why is it that everything always goes wrong? Why can't I have a happy, peaceful life? I must be dumb. So what you do, you decide that the problem is with your bus driver. It doesn't know how to drive a car, always goes into the wrong places. Goes into the toxic waste dumps of life. The nuclear disaster zones of your mind. That's where you tend to go to. Why do you do that? Stupid. So you want to go to the beautiful places. Just the rolling green fields, carpeted with flowers, the bubbling brooks and the delightful waterfalls and sunset, where everything is nice and warm and wonderful. That's where you want to hang out. So you decide that you have to tell your bus driver where to go. When you go to bad places, accelerate, get out quick. When you go to nice places, slow down. Because your bus driver, whenever you have happy experiences, it accelerates, speeds out of them. Whenever you get into pain and difficulty and suffering, it's amazing how long your bus driver parks there. Stupid bus driver. So before your bus driver, you know, it's your will. So before you can actually teach your bus driver your will, you've got to find that thing first of all. So you can actually go and teach it something. So you look around in meditation, what is this will, what is it? And finally, in meditation, you come to your bus driver's seat, the place in your mind where the will lives, the thing directing you. You know, you want to try and find a control center, find out where everything comes from, and you expect maybe to see there this little girl with a mouse and typing up all the instructions of what you're supposed to do in life. You know, or I don't know what you think is the controller inside of you, how you can visualize it, but you find the bus driver's seat. And that is where you get the shock of your life. There is no bus driver in the seat. Your body and mind is like a Google car. No bus driver in there. Have you seen the Google cars? Really, I've seen them. I'm a monk. Maybe it's because, you know, they're dumber cars. There's no driver in them. All you do, apparently, you sit in a Google car. It's done by Google Corporation. You program in where you want to go, and there's no driver. You sit in there, and it's all, you know, remote sensors. They can know where the traffic is. They can respond immediately to any oncoming cars. They can stop at the traffic lights. You can't speed. You can't go through a red light. You can't do anything wrong. You just sit there. And a Google car takes you to where you want to go, parks automatically, and then you get out. You don't drive at all. Totally automatic. That is so much like you. You're all Google human beings. There's no drive inside. It's all programmed. Just like the Google car. That's why I think we should get one, because it's dumber. You know, it might be expensive, but you know, it's a great teaching aid. And I can also use it to get from Jhana Grove over to the monastery without having to wait for the Anagarika to pick me up. So one day we'll get one of those. Actually, I'm going to Google in February, so maybe I'll ask Chade Meng if he can get one for me. At a cut price, you know a few people. They owe you a few favours. We can use it for advertising. Google cars as used by Buddhist monks. Is that a good idea? You know, is that sort of degrading Buddhism for the sake of God? Anyway, let's go back to this. You find the bright driver, there's no one in there. Your will is empty. Nothing there. All done by programming like a Google car. Cause and effect. You think it's you making the choices, but it's not. As Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T, found about 10 or 15 years ago, he did this amazing experiment. He had experimenters, you know, just decide to flex their fist. You know, you can choose to do it, choose not to do it. Very simple. At the same time, on a button, when you chose to flex your fist, you press the button. When you're aware of the choice, press the button, flex the wrist at the same time. Also, they had some scanner on their brain. And when actually you start to flex your wrist, there's something he called the readiness potential. You can see it light up in the brain. That starts the process for flexing the wrist. And he wanted to find out, this thing which we assume to be our choice and our will, does that occur before the readiness potential or afterwards? And what Professor Libet found was this readiness potential in the brain. The brain turns on, makes a choice, first of all, totally unconscious. The next thing is, a few milliseconds later, I think 0.7 of a second, that you are aware that now I am choosing, and then you move. What you take to be the will, what you can observe to be choice, does not originate the action. The origin happens unconsciously before you're aware of it. So what you take to be will is not the start of the process, but it's midway through the process. That is what you assume to be your will. By the time you choose, it's already happening, and you can't stop it. So when you choose to move your glasses, were you aware that you chose to move the glasses? By the time you were aware of that choice, it was inevitable. The brain had chosen, then you were aware, then you moved. Will is not under your control. It's not the originator of action. It's part of it. It's conditioned first, then this thing we take to be will is not the start of the process. It's in the middle of the process, and then you do things. Just like the Buddha said. And that's what you see in deep meditation. You aren't the one who makes the decisions. It's empty, non-self. And all this willing causes so much problems and difficulties. So you stop. Once you see the bus driver's seat is empty, you go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. You stop shouting at the bus driver, "Stupid me, I made a wrong choice, that's bad, that's good." There's no bus driver to shout at. What a waste of time all this likes and dislikes are. All this wanting and not wanting. All this this ill will and just praise and blame and stuff. What a waste of time that is. That's just shouting at the empty bus driver's seat. Craving stops when you realize there's no one in here. Now that's actually what happens. That is anatta. Anicca, will is vanished. Dukkha, will is the pain. That's actually what happens. Now you may agree with that. You may disagree with that. You may be totally bamboozled. Because there's no way you can understand anicca, dukkha, or anatta unless things vanish. If the will is always there, how can you ever know it? If your body is always there, how can you ever know it? If the knower is always there, you can't understand it. Even that vanishes too. Bye-bye. And that's freaky. But it's so blissful. Not having this irritation of having to know things. How much do you know? Do you know enough yet? Can you know everything? It's impossible to know everything. So knowing is an endless journey. This is why, after a while, when we understand that, then we can stop and let go. Why do you want to know anyway? It's a nice question. Why do you want to know? That's an irritation of the brain. That's all. So after a while, when you realize all of this, then you can turn off. There's nothing there. Nothing to do. As Ajahn Chah once told me, when he met me and I just come out of a great meditation, and he looked me in the eye, knowing I was really peaceful, my hindrances were absent, a great chance to enlighten his Western disciple, he looked me in the eye and said, "Brahma Wangso!" Just to get my attention, really fierce, kind but fierce and strong. "Brahma Wangso! Why?" He asked me the question, why? The deep question. And my mind was clear. My mind was strong. And the answer just came out automatically. "I don't know." "How would I know? I was only about 3 or 4 years as a monk." That was really stupid. But you know, for Ajahn Chah, the stupid disciples he had gave him so much happiness. He was laughing and laughing and laughing at all the stupid things we did. He couldn't believe, you know, because he'd been taught that Westerners were advanced. And in reality, we were stupid. "But he went to Cambridge University, he's intelligent." Ajahn, "No, he's not." I didn't know. Well, that's too deep for me, the question of why from a great master. And no, he couldn't make it up, so I didn't know, so I said so. These people were honest, which is good. And then, after finishing laughing, he looked at me again. "Baba Wangsa, I will tell you the answer." That's one of the magic moments. I can visualize it now. You know, there's some times in your life which are so powerful. You know, when you start thinking about them, you can actually fill in all the details, exactly where it was, what was happening, everything. And then I said, "I'll tell you the answer." And I was really excited. This was a great monk, and he was going to tell me personally, no one else around. the answer to the question, why? So I was all ears, yes. And then he told me the answer, and the answer was, there is nothing. There's nothing. And he looked at me again, very profound. The answer to the question was, there's nothing. No will, no consciousness, nothing. And then he said, do you understand? Really kindly, like someone who really cares for you, do you understand? And I said, yes. And that's when he looked at me and said, no, you don't. And just, you're raised so high and you pull straight down. That was just such a bummer of a moment. But I always remember that. It was a great little moment, you know, with a great master, like a Zen koan, you know. Why? You know, I don't know. Okay, I'll tell you the answer. There's nothing. Do you understand? Yes. No, you don't. So, to finish off the talk, do you understand? Sorry, no, you don't. But it gives you something to focus on. A great little mystery and a riddle. What does that mean? The answer to the question, why? There's nothing. What's the cause? There's nothing. Emptiness. No self. Word is just a process, empty process. The knower the same, just a process. Because it's an empty process, then it can stop. Nothing gets destroyed in a process. If there's something there to begin with, then of course you can't just destroy anything. There's a conservation of mass energy in science. Which is one of the reasons why when people ask, how could this universe come into existence? Where did all this stuff come from? It can't come from nothing. That's a basic law of philosophy and also science. Conservation of mass energy. You can't create it, you can't destroy it, it just transforms into different forms, that's all. So all this stuff of the universe, where did it come from? And the answer is, there is such a thing called dark. No, not negative energy. Not dark matter, sorry, negative energy. Potential energy is one form of it. You know, a mass in a gravitational field, like, you know, my massive body on the Earth. You get pulled to the Earth. That's why it's so difficult to get up after the talk. It's not me, it's just gravity. It's just physics. I can't argue with that. That's potential energy. So to take my body and to take it into outer space takes a lot of energy. This is a negative energy because I'm in a gravitational field. You can imagine, just have the right amount of energy and you take it out of the Earth's gravitational field. It just uses up all the energy which it has now, and so it's zero energy when it goes out. That's called negative energy. So I remember asking the professor of physics at University of Western Australia, David Blair. I asked him once, he said, yeah, you know, negative energy, see, I know what you mean, that's valid. What if the amount of negative energy in this universe exactly equal the amount of positive energy? So the sum total of mass energy is zero. And he looked at me, and I remember that look. Wow, you're up to date. I think that was only released 2 months ago or something. Omega equals one, he said. I don't know what omega was, but it meant like mass, negative energy and positive energy in this universe totally balance out. That's why this universe can come from nothing. Because there's nothing here. It's just a balance of energies. If all this whole universe would come together, and if all the star systems, the galaxies and everything would come together, it would vanish. Because there's nothing there. Just like you. You came from nothing, you are nothing, and you'll go back to nothing. Nothing is greater than God. That's enough. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yes, do. Very good. Okay. Have a nice time.